Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this, our special Easter Monday feature program. What we're celebrating over the Easter Triduum, Pope Benedict said in his general audience of Holy Week, is the supreme confrontation between light and darkness, between life and death. In churches, chapels, and great cathedrals throughout the world, Easter vigils, which began in the darkness of Saturday night, celebrated the light and life of Jesus breaking through into our lives by his resurrection on Sunday morning. Easter candles are lit and now burn brightly to symbolise the light of Christ, which can overcome evil even in the darkest places. Stay with us then for the next half hour as Jill Bevilacqua presents a programme of reflections on darkness and light, taken from her series Creation, an adventure into the greatest happening of all time.
God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. God saw that light was good, and God divided light from darkness. God called light day, and darkness he called night.
The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. To them that dwell in the region of the shadow of death, light is risen. And the moon shall blush, and the sun shall be ashamed, when the Lord of hosts shall reign on Mount Zion. And the light of the moon shall be as the sun, and the light of the sun shall be sevenfold, as the light of 7 days, in the day when the Lord shall bind up the wound of his people.
From the words of the prophet Isaiah to those of modern writer on spirituality, Carlo Carretto.
It is odd, but nonetheless true, that too much light can seem like darkness. If I try and look at the sun, everything goes black. Nothing could be truer, nothing more opaque than the existence of God. Nothing could be clearer, more rational, more tangible than the creation of the universe by God. Nothing more mysterious. Nothing could be more evident than the eternity of the soul. Nothing more painfully dark at the moment of death. In our relationship with the transcendent God, we enter the regions of faith, and faith is dark, obscure. Because he is a creature, man is immersed in darkness, in the mystery which is not a lack of light, but the reflection of a light which far exceeds him. That light is so new that he is obliged to undergo a gradual education and revelation which will engage his entire existence.
The 19th century naturalist Henri Fabre made a surprising discovery about butterflies that have to fly in the dark.
The weather was stormy, the sky heavily clouded, the darkness profound. It was across this maze of leafage and in absolute darkness that the butterflies had to find their way in order to attain the end of their pilgrimage. Under such conditions, the screech owl would not dare to forsake its olive tree. The butterfly goes forward without hesitation. So well it directs its tortuous flight, that in spite of all the obstacles to be evaded, It arrives in a state of perfect freshness, its great wings intact. The darkness is light enough.
For most of us, night is a time to be indoors, tucked up between sheets and under a roof. For Robert Louis Stevenson, travelling with a donkey in the Cévennes, things were different.
Night is a dead, monotonous period under a roof, but in the open world it passes lightly, with its stars and dews and perfumes, and the hours are marked by changes in the face of nature. What seems a kind of temporal death to people choked between walls and curtains is only a light and living slumber to the man who sleeps afield. All night long, he can hear nature breathing deeply and freely. Even as she takes her rest, she turns and smiles. And there is one stirring hour unknown to those who dwell in houses, when a wakeful influence goes abroad over the sleeping hemisphere and all the outdoor world are on their feet. It is then that the cock first crows, not this time to announce the dawn, but like a cheerful watchman speeding the course of night. Cattle awake on the meadows, sheep break their fast on dewy hillsides, and change to a new lair among the ferns. And houseless men, who have lain down with the fowls, open their dim eyes and behold the beauty of the night.
Day comes at last, and for Pippa, in Browning's Pippa Passes, the coming of day is a tremendous, joyful happening.
Day. Faster and more fast, o'er night's brim, day boils at last. Boils pure gold o'er the cloud cup's brim where spurting and suppressed it lay. For not a froth flake touched the rim of yonder gap in the solid grey of the eastern cloud an hour away. But forth one wavelet, then another curled, till the whole sunrise, not to be suppressed, rose, reddened, and its seething breast flickered in bounds, grew gold, then overflowed the world.
Back to Stevenson, who has now awoken on his French hillside.
When I awoke again, many of the stars had disappeared. Only the stronger companions of the night still burned visibly overhead. And away towards the east, I saw a faint haze of light upon the horizon, such as had been the Milky Way when I was last awake. Day was at hand. I lit my lantern, and by its glowworm light put on my boots and gaiters. The blue darkness lay long in the glade where I had so sweetly slumbered, but soon there was a broad streak of orange melting into gold along the mountain tops. 10 minutes after, the sunlight spread at a gallop along the hillside, scattering shadows and sparkles, and the day had come completely.
From music to painting. Now, in paintings, light is presented in many ways. It's present as natural or artificial light, violent or gentle. Even if its source is not present in the painting itself, light is always there. Leonardo da Vinci was the first artist to realise the importance of light and shade, and he was also the first painter to use natural light, representing it at different times of day. Caravaggio and his successors used light in a dramatic way. Often a beam of light illuminated one person, making him or her the protagonist. Again, light was used to represent God. In the stained glass windows of churches, there's a fusion of light, the result of the artist's work combined with the presence of real light. Here, light is the protagonist, not light created by the artist, but true natural light. A particular experience of light is that of the aurora borealis, known as the Northern Lights. It occurs near or radiates from the Earth's northern or southern magnetic pole. The Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins recorded his vision from the hills in the English Midlands.
First saw the Northern Lights. My eye was caught by beams of light and dark, very like the crown of horny rays the sun makes behind a cloud. At first I thought of silvery cloud, until I saw that these were more luminous and did not dim the clearness of the stars in the bear. They rose, slightly radiating, thrown out from the earth line. Then I saw soft pulses of light, one after another, rise and pass upwards, arched in shape but wavering and with the arch broken. They seemed to float, not following the warp of the sphere, as falling stars look to do, but free, though concentrical with it. This busy working of nature, wholly independent of the earth, and seeming to go on in a strain of time not reckoned by our reckoning of days and years, but simpler, and as if correcting the preoccupation of the world by being preoccupied with and appealing to and dated to the day of judgment, was like a new witness to God and filled me with delightful fear.
Darkness, when it is loss of sight, can produce bitterness, but John Milton was inspired to write a sonnet.
When I consider how my light is spent ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent which is death to hide lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve there with my Maker and present my true account, lest he, returning, chide. Doth God exact day labour, light denied, I fondly ask? But patience to prevent that murmur soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait.
Truly the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. So we read in Ecclesiastes. And again, there is nothing new under the sun. St. Matthew writes, he makes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good. And St. Paul told the Ephesians not to let the sun go down upon their anger. While in Revelation St. John declared that neither shall the sun light on them, nor any heat. Our secular writers now, Robert Louis Stevenson, writes of sunrise after a night sleeping in the open.
The stars were not yet quite extinguished. The heaven was of that enchanting mild grey-blue of the early morn. A still clear light began to fall, and the trees on the hillside were outlined sharply against the sky. And looking up, I was surprised to see the cloud dyed with gold. In these high regions of the air, the sun was already shining as at noon. If only the clouds travelled high enough, we should see the same thing all night long, for it is always daylight in the fields of space. As I began to go up the valley, a draught of wind came down it out of the seat of the sunrise, although the clouds continued to run overhead in an almost contrary direction. A few steps farther, and I saw a whole hillside gilded with the sun, and still a little beyond, between two peaks, a centre of dazzling brilliancy appeared floating in the sky, and I was once more face to face with the big bonfire that occupies the kernel of our system.
From the same writer's Child's Garden of Verses come these lines.
Great is the sun, and wide he goes through empty heaven without repose. And in the blue and glowing days, more thick than rain, he showers his rays. Though closer still the blinds we pull to keep the shady parlour cool, yet he will find a chink or two to slip his golden fingers through. The dusty attic, spider-clad, he through the keyhole maketh glad, and through the broken edge of tiles into the laddered hayloft smiles. Meantime his golden face around he bears to all the garden ground, and sheds a warm and glittering look among the ivy's inmost nook. Above the hills, along the blue, round the bright air with footing true, to please the child, to paint the rose, the gardener of the world he goes.
The quality of the sun in the desert was recorded by another 19th century traveller, Charles Doughty, in Deserta Arabica.
The summer's night at end, the sun stands up as a crown of hostile flames from that huge covert of inhospitable sandstone bergs. The desert day dawns not little and little, but it is noontide in an hour. The sun, entering as a tyrant upon the waste landscape, darts upon us a torment of fiery beams, not to be remitted till the far-off evening. No matins here of birds. Not a rock-partridge cock calling with blithesome chuckle over the extreme waterless desolation. Grave is that giddy heat upon the crown of the head. The ears tingle with a flickering shrillness, a subtle crepitation, it seems, in the glassiness of this sun-stricken nature. The hot sand blink is in the eyes, and there is little refreshment to find in the tent's shelter. The worsted booths leak to this fiery rain of sunny light. Mountains looming like dry bones through the thin air stand far around about us. The lingering day draws down to the sun setting. The herdsmen, weary of the sun, come again with the cattle to taste in their camping grounds the first sweetness of mirth and repose. The day is done. The moon rises, ruddy from that solemn obscurity of Jebel, like a mighty beacon, and the morrow will be as this day. Days deadly drowned in the sun of the summer wilderness.
Lewis Carroll had some fun with the sun in The Walrus and the Carpenter.
The sun was shining on the sea, shining with all his might. He did his very best to make the billows smooth and bright. And this was odd, because it was the middle of the night. Thank you.
Pope Innocent III had his own ideas about the sun.
The creator of the universe set up two great luminaries in the firmament of heaven, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. In the same way, for the firmament of the universal church, which is spoken of as heaven, he appointed two great dignities. The greater to bear rule over souls, those being, as it were, days, the lesser to bear rule over bodies, those being, as it were, knights. These dignities are the pontifical authority and the royal power. Furthermore, the moon derives her light from the sun and is in truth inferior to the sun in both size and quality, in position as well as effect. In the same way, the royal power derives its dignity from the pontifical authority. And the more closely it cleaves to the sphere of that authority, the less is the light with which it is adorned. The further it is removed, the more it increases in splendor.
Writing in the First World War, soldier poet Wilfred Owen stood in the sunlight and mourned the death of a young companion. Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once, at home, whispering of fields unsown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds, woke once the clays of a cold star. Our limbs so dear achieved, our sides full-nerved, still warm, too hard to stir. Was it for this the clay grew tall? Oh, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all? And now Jesuit Father Lars Ruth talks about the sun and the Christian's vision of it.
Through the ages, people have often even looked upon the sun as a god, and they were not far off, as it is probably the most important part of creation as far as we are concerned. Should the solar activity stop, it would not take more than 8 minutes before life on our planet came to complete finish. It would not only be dark, but temperature would drop close to absolute zero, causing the very air we breathe to liquefy and fall as rain. The universe and the sun and life are signs of the Creator. And as Christians, we trust that one day, when time is over for us as individuals, eternity takes over. Not a dreary long period, but the fullness of God and His presence. Using human language, St. Paul tells us that we shall then see God face to face. So the sun is a sign of the warmth of God's love for us. He created us in time, but for himself and his eternity. And the prospect that the sun would one day set should not frighten us, but rather fill us with hopeful joy.
And now American poet Robert Frost gives us his version of sunlight in Standing by a Bush in Broad Sunlight.
When I spread out my hand here today, I catch no more than a ray to feel of between thumb and fingers. No lasting effect of it lingers. There was one time, and only the one, when dust really took in the sun. And from that one intake of fire, all creatures still warmly suspire. And if men have watched a long time and never seen sun-smitten slime again come to life and crawl off, we must not be too ready to scoff. God once declared he was true and then took the veil and withdrew. And remember how final a hush then descended of old on the bush. God once spoke to people by name. The sun once imparted its flame. One impulse persists as our breath, the other persists as our faith.
Perhaps the most striking episode concerning the sun is recorded in the Old Testament in the book of Joshua.
Joshua declaimed, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and moon, you also." And the sun stood still, and the moon halted, till the people had vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of the just? The sun stood still in the middle of the sky and delayed its setting for almost a whole day. There was never a day like that before or since when Yahweh obeyed the voice of a man.
And we conclude as we began with Isaiah in a triumphant, joyful prophecy.
Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and the thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will be seen upon you, and nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. The sun shall be no more your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give you light by night. But the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun shall no more go down, nor your moon withdraw itself. For the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning shall be ended.
And you were listening there to Jill Bevilacqua presenting a program of reflections on darkness and light, taken from her series Creation, an adventure into the greatest happening of all time. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. You can always find all our news and feature programs on the internet as well. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio, and from all of us here at the English program, I wish you a very bright and happy Easter week. Laudato Jesus Christus.